Okyo Zammai, the jeweled mirror samadhi, the most excellent mirror samadhi. This is a poem by Dongshan. We know him a little better in our ancestral line as Tozan, who is, along with his disciple, Cao Shan, the founder of the Soto tradition. Two names come from that. Cao Dong. The Shan means, of course, mountain. It refers to where the two monks trained and where their abbey was. And they took the name of the mountain because they were mountains. This poem, which is in Chinese, is the meaning of which you already know. And you know that you know it because you have been doing meditation. But you may not know that you know that you know it. And therefore the poem is written to help you know that you know it. Hey, would you please? Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you. Not yet. There it is. Thank you. To begin with, when you go into meditation and you sit, you enter a state which is called a samadhi. And the state that you go in is called the most excellent mirror, samadhi. And you may not know that that is what you do, but it is what you do. I would suspect, if you think back to when you first began to meditate, when you first sat, what came up for you as the very first thing? I don't mean on a personal level, but on a general level. I would suspect that it is pretty much the same for almost everyone. It is the pain in my ankles, or my knees, or my back, or my neck, or my shoulders, or my here, or my there, but it's some kind of physical pain is the first thing that arises. And usually one spends one's meditation periods at the beginning thinking, how can I endure this pain? What am I going to do about this pain? This is terrible. This is, what is this? How does this lead to anything other than suffering? Yes, this is suffering. And one goes, truly, I am enlightened. I now know what suffering is. And the thing is that this is what happens with most people who sit in meditation. The physical skanda arises first. And as Dogen says, drop off body and mind. Let go of body and mind. So the first thing you let go of is your body in meditation. You let it go. And how do you let it go? Well, you're sitting there in meditation for a while, and after you have done it for a certain period of time, you suddenly forget that your ankles were sore because you've forgotten all about it. They've gotten adjusted. Your body has gotten adjusted to sitting in meditation. Although it may take a few sessions or a few years, but it happens, and that is the dropping off of body. You will notice this because what will usually arise next are feelings. Because this is the second skanda, and these come up. And you begin to become aware of how you feel about things. And usually about how the pain was or is, but there's a feelings will arise. And as you let go of your feelings, then your ideas get going, your opinions, your values, your thoughts about things, what you think things are, what you think meditation is, and all of this goes on. And then you let go of that. When you really are willing to let go of that, then what arises are the mental formations, just the images that arise. And then you watch those, you know, look at those things that come into the mind. And then you let go of that. And consciousness arises. You're conscious. I'm nothing else. I am. This is a dangerous stage because you can get to bliss in this. Bliss out, as they say. And just until you let go of that too. What you are doing throughout this whole thing, however, is you have entered into the meditational state in which you are looking into the great jeweled mirror, which is your mind. And it is what you see there. And that is what you're doing in meditation. You are serenely reflecting and being reflected in the mirror. And that's what you're doing. And this is what this is talking about. What you see. What's really going on. All of you know these things. You've been doing it. So as soon as you've said that you've sat in meditation, you've looked into the mirror. Now, you may not have realized that's what you were doing. Do not sit there and think, I'm looking into the mirror. I'm looking into the mirror. Because that's holding on to a concept. Let go of that, too. Let go. And do not worry with what... That's right. Do not worry with what arises. Do not push it away. Do not hold on to it. Because it is simply reflections. And you can no more take a hold of those reflections than you can take hold of water. You cannot grasp upon them. They do not stay. They come and they go. You can try to hold on to them. You can get fascinated by them. You can be horrified by them. Those are just feelings. And they are arising in the mirror too. So let them arise and let them go. So he begins the most excellent mirror samadhi by saying, the Buddhas and the ancestors have all directly handed down this basic truth. Preserve well, for you now have. This is all. One of the things that happens to the mind when it hears that, that is very common for the human mind, is to say, have what? What is it? It. A feeling, I've got to stick an it or a something onto this to make it be a sentence that makes sense to me. Aha, what are we doing? We're trying to make sense out of something, to have it have meaning fixed so I can feel comfortable, I can feel at ease, I've worked it out, I have done something big, I have comprehended it. And that has got to be let go of. You now have. There is a famous koan story. It is probably one of the most famous in all of Zen. A young monk, and we come into the middle of it, by the way, the story is never told in its whole form, but always starts with the young monk, what he has asked. And he asks of the master Joshua, and it's by what he says that we know him, and how he asks the question, because that is always important as we know. Getting back to the dog, does it have a Buddha nature? Yes or no? And Joshua, of course, answered, ooh. Or in Japanese, mu, which unfortunately gets translated as no. But that is not the way one would answer the question. If one wanted to answer the question no, one would not answer it with the word mu in Chinese, because the question is shibushir, yes or no. Is it or is it not? And if he had meant no, he would have said busher. But he didn't. He said mu. It does not exist. It isn't a matter of whether a dog has a Buddha nature or doesn't have a Buddha nature. A Buddha nature does not exist. You now have. But you do not have a thing called a Buddha nature, which you hold on into is yours. I got my Buddha nature right in here. There is this place in the scripture that says, you have Buddha nature. And Dogen said, you are Buddha nature. But you do not, there is nothing you possess or have. There is nothing to possess. And there's nothing we can possess except with a deluded mind. What can we possess and hold that we can call our own that won't dissolve in time and change? There is nothing. We have Buddha nature. We are Buddha nature. Preserve well, because you now have. This is all. That's it. Now, I could then say, okay, this is end talk. Night. And go on. But the master had a little bit more to say. And we will look at a little bit more of what he has to say. And what he has to say will be an expansion upon this. The white snow falls upon the silver plate. Snowy hair and the bright moon hides. Resembles each the other, yet these two are not the same. Combining them, we can distinguish one from other. Okay, now, what does it mean? What does the white snow fall upon the silver plate? You have been in meditation. You all know this. What is the white snow? What is the silver plate? Is it code? Does it have a deep, secret meaning? Does it have a shallow meaning? You're the advanced people. You tell me.
Yeah. Does it mean all is one and all is different?
It means all is one and all indifferent, and it is all is different, not indifferent. And what does that mean?
It means that we are the Buddha nature, but we each have a different personality.
All right, that can be certainly come out of it. What else? Yeah.
All the activities of the white snow fall serenely upon the great mirror of Buddha nature.
Possible? Do not be afraid. Does something come? Let it arise.
Where's Ted Nuinger about snow falling on the plate and actually melting?
All right. What happens to it after it melts?
Well, it continues to change form, but still maintain its essence of water. But it changes. It still has its like basic essence, but it changes form in the interaction.
Okay. White snow. That's a connection with the water of the spirit. Oh, somebody said, like, now I know what it means. Do not know what it means. Enjoy your ignorance, or not your ignorance, your non-knowing. It is a state that is very, very nice not to know. Because that can open up things. As soon as you know, you have closed the door. Yes?
To me, they're both invisible. When I see the snow falling on a plate, it disappears when it hits the plate, and the snowy heron in the white moon hides, so you can't see the heron and you can't see the snow on the plate.
All right. There are times when we can see things and there are times we cannot see things. Right. And there is the one and the other, and there is no value given to one over the other. It isn't the awful snow falling on the beautiful silver plate, which adds a dimension with it, is not there. That's the human tendency to judge, to evaluate something. All is one and all is different. And we can see this. We have the capacity to see this. we have the capacity to know the eternal and to know that which is transitory. The phenomena, the things that arise, the things that change. The things that exist for a while, disintegrate, and disappear into the emptiness. Into the realm of the Lord of the empty, of emptiness, as it sometimes is called. End and beginning here return unto the source. And high and low are used, supreme mind, in words, can never be expressed. I call this here the eternal. Reverend Master spoke of immaculacy. I sometimes speak of the unbounded. Someone else speaks of it this way. Someone else speaks of it that way. It's convenient. It's a convenient way of talking. It's a convenient way of indicating that there is something. But whatever, it goes beyond any words that we have to express it. And when we say, yes, I understand, we understand in the realm of words. And this is all talking about something beyond the realm of words. And yet, to all the trainee's needs, it does respond. As you train, you will have needs. They will arise. And if you recognize that, those needs, not your wants, but your needs, supreme mind, what he calls supreme mind here, will respond. Enslaved by words, you fall into a hole. You know, you get caught into the words, you know, that's the pit. It's thinking that, well, I've got an explanation. I read the book. He wrote a wonderful commentary. I read it. Marv, you've got to read this book. You've really got to read this book. It's going to be caught in the worlds, concepts.
Can I get you to back up this a minute?
Yeah.
If I heard you correctly, you said that if the trainee knows their needs.
And if the trainee doesn't know their needs, but to all the needs of the trainee, the Supreme Mind helps and responds.
Okay.
It's the wants we got to watch out for.
Right.
If you go against the basic truth, you come to a dead end. If you think you're going to train and get something, there is a statement of this which comes up quite often in my mind. I rarely use Christian things, but this, there is a thing of, keeps coming up, and I don't remember it exactly, but seek and ye shall find, knock, and it shall be opened unto you. And so it goes on, this kind of thing. But there's another passage that says, ye ask, but you receive not, because ye ask amiss, that you might consume it upon your lust. That is similar in what is being said there. You ask and you will receive. What you need will be given to you. But if you go against the basic truth and say, okay, I'm going to use this. I've come here to train so that I can have a Kensho, and then I can go out and I can just have a ball on the feeding off of this Kensho. I can cash in. I can go around being holy. I can go around marketing this thing, my ability, my deeper understanding of things. If that is what you're here for, to try to do that, you will come to a dead end. And that kind of thing can come up. And don't be afraid if such thoughts come up. They're just the things reflected in the mirror. Just something that arises, persists for a while, and say goodbye to it. Mm-hmm. So, this is as if a giant fireball. Never come too close, nor put yourself too far away. Don't overdo it. Don't zealously seek the truth and go after it. All your effort, I'm going to get the truth, I'm going to get the truth, because you get too close. on the other side and say, oh, well, I don't have to do anything. I'll wait until the divine whatever, you know, touches me on the head and I will be enlightened and all that kind of thing. And I won't have to do any work about it. Just do your training, your daily training. That's it. Just keep at it. Just keep at it. And don't worry about it. And don't try to get too close to it. Don't stay too far apart from it. If you express by fancy words, it's all stained. This is the problem that many scholars have, of turning out things that are unintelligible. They're all in fancy words. Oh, they're big words.
I don't know what they're talking about.
They mean nothing. Now, as a comment on the side on this, because it, and I bring this up because this, these lines in this can function in many different ways than just what I'm talking about here. If I were asked to train people to do translation work, the first thing I would have them do is to copy those lines in the nicest calligraphy they could, to frame it and put it above on the wall, right in front of them, and the desk that they work at.
Which words?
And they are the words, never come too close, nor put yourself too far away. If you express by fancy words, it is all stained. And those are the words for a translator. If you get too literal, too stuck on the words, or if you go trampling off into paraphrasing something that has nothing to do with what the text says, you've gone too far away. And if you use heavy-duty language, or get it all too flowery and roodly-doodly, then it will be all stained. The night encloses brightness, and at dawn no light shines. We tend to think of the darkness that we are in, something permanent, something forever, and something we can see no way out of if we are in the darkness. It is the darkness of ignorance. And there's always the brightness within it. And we do not necessarily see it when we're in it. But it is there. When the training really gets tough, when the training really gets hard, when it really gets painful, you're in the night, and that's when you're doing your best work, probably, on the thing. Because you're sort of having to do something and having to let go of things so that the light can be there, and you will ultimately know what that light is in the darkness. For at dawn, no light shines. The dawning of the realization of truth is not an angelic choir singing in the background with soupy violins as you have this wonderful thing of the great world opens and everything is it. Doesn't work that way. It's just something very calm, very quiet. This truth holds for beings all. This isn't just for me, it isn't just for Dongshan, it's for every single solitary being. This is our inheritance. This is what we are innately. And it holds for all of us. And one of the things that creates the darkness is the erroneous belief that we cannot know the truth. That we cannot know it. That it could, oh, Shakyamuni Buddha, yeah, what he did was wonderful, and gee, I'd like to be free of suffering, but I cannot be Shakyamuni Buddha. There's only one, that got happened a long time ago, and here I am. It is for all. Do not doubt that. That is the element of faith that is fundamental. Because because sometimes that's all you're going to have to get you through something that can be for you a terrible dark night. Is to say, I accept the night, I embrace the night, I do not know what to do, I do not know which way to go, I do not know how to turn, and I will trust. And to your needs, it will respond. But you have to be willing just to go on your faith and ask nothing. Ask nothing. Because what you need will be given to you. But as soon as you ask, you may be then putting limitations on the eternal, saying, you have three options here to fulfill my needs. You know, take A, B, or C, and you limit. And there's a tendency. I need money. So I will pray for money. I will ask for money. I need it. I need it. I don't know what I'm going to do if I don't have money. But you may not have money. But if you have your faith, that what you need, what you really need, it will be given in ways which will astound you. I do not say this in theory. And I'm not going to tell you certain stories, but it is so. And it's there for you. But do not ask for things that you can use to satisfy your greeds. And that's what you know, you want to make sure you don't do. Let go of them. And see what you really need. And sometimes it's something very simple. And that's all you need. Which you'd never even think of because it is so simple. But it can come that way. This truth holds for being all, beings all. To this we free ourselves from suffering. This is what faith will do. It will free you from your suffering. Although not made by artifice, this truth can find expression in the words of those who teach true Zen. Granted that words, if you get caught up in the words and come to try to understand everything and put it down on notes and so forth, you're using words. Zen masters use words. But they're not talking about the truth. They're using language to do something else. And that is to help you realize the truth that is there, that you already know, but may not realize. It's there for you. And, on the other hand, as Dogen has pointed out, how am I to tell you this in words? How can I find a way to express it so that you will know what it is and see what it is that you need to see? This is why when we're in meditation, we try to get out of our heads. We sit with the mind in the hara. Get it out of the thinking part. Get it down into the hara and keep it there. Bring it down to the hara. Down to the hara. Because that's where you're going to hear something. That's where the child is. That's when men become women. Oh, you didn't know. Well, yes, they do. The men become women. Because they have to give birth to the child. Just as the women have to give birth to the child. Which is the child of the Lord. It is as if one looks into a jeweled mirror, seeing both shadow and substance. But most of what we see is just that, shadow. Just the things that flip upon the mirror. Things that seem to have substance, things that seem to be real, and have a kind of reality. a provisional reality for a while, but it just flashes through the mind. And that is the whole universe that flashes through our mind as well. Do not distinguish between just inner images, but the whole outside world is a reflection as well. So it's inner and outer. There's no difference. They're all parts of the mind, and we have ways of doing it. They have a reality, a provisional reality, but they have no permanence, no absolute abiding. Nothing lasts. If it's a thing, it does not last forever. And thoughts are things, and they don't last forever. And while we're trying to hold on to them, we've already forgotten about them. You are not him, he is all of you. Do not make the mistake that because you are Buddha nature, that you think you are Buddha nature, and place yourself in some kind of an exalted state. Everything is. And he is all of you. A baby of this world is such as this, possessing all his five sense organs, like adults, yet goes not, and neither comes, neither arises nor yet stays, has words and yet no words. And as it says in the Chinese, he says, ba ba wa wa. That's the original. He has words and yet no words. And the baby, of course, that arises, does not judge things, does not name things, does not go around insisting upon things. It just exists and responds openly and directly to whatever. And at the same time, do not try to return yourself to a state of minor idiocy, of saying, I wander off in the space. A baby does need someone to take care of it. Then finally we grasp nothing. In both senses of grasp. We do not understand something, we don't grab after it. There's nothing to be understood, there is nothing to be grasped. Nothing to be get hold of, nothing to be comprehended. It's so simple, it's so easy, that we want to make it difficult and complex for ourselves. Because it's right there at all times. This is the meaning of you are enlightened just as you are. Nothing to get. You already got it. You have. Therefore you don't. And yet to think, oh, I have. No, when you have that kind of have, you don't have it at that moment. Not that you have lost it, but that you do not yet know what it means. And then we come to a lovely passage, a passage that most people say, what does this mean? Oh, he's got to explain this one to us. This is a very important section. I could say it's very precious, and therefore I will leave it without any comments on it. But I will indulge me. When stacked, six sticks of reed forever move in mutual relations in extremes and center. Stack three times, return again to the first pattern after changes five. This, as the five tastes of the cheatgrass seems, and as the diamond scepter branches five. The absolute upright holds, as it is, many phenomena within its own delicate balance. This is the one that the scholars have fun with, of trying to figure out what it is talking about. If you really want to know what it's talking about, I would recommend to you that you read The Lotus Blossom, the Master's Lotus Blossom, where she takes this very thing up. Because it is the experience that she has, the absolute upright, which is the spine, and the five tastes of the cheatgrass refers to the five, are called the goi, which are the five levels, or the five circles, sometimes they're called. And in that is the relationship between the eternal and the transitory. And the first level is the eternal within the transitory. And that is the snow, the water of the Spirit, falling into the silver bowl. And the transitory within the eternal is the next one. The heron in the moon, hides in the moon. And then the next is when the one sees that. Okay, the first part is the eternal within the transitory. That is when you begin to look up and begin to realize there is something more or other than just the flow of the transitory. The flow of the transitory, if one takes only that and says, all right, there is the flow of the transitory, and when that flow, which I call me, dies, that's it. There's nothing. There's emptiness. There's the void. There's total nihilism. There's only the transitory and nothing else. There's nothing else at all. But when you realize that there is, because there is the transitory, as the Buddha said, there is that which goes beyond the transitory. And were not so, he could not have been freed from what he had held on to. And that's called the looking up, whatever Master called it, the looking up. And one sees that everything that passes is happening within that eternal, which is the second level. And in terms of your practice, it's when you see what your koan is, what your spiritual question is. And your spiritual question is not an intellectual question. It's something far deeper. And you realize that then, whatever it is, it requires cleansing to clean up the mess, to clean up whatever it is that is keeping you from the eternal, so that you can get beyond that to the eternal, so it no longer stands in your way. For some people it's called the doubt. What is the doubt that one has? The doubt that I can realize it. Why do you doubt that you can realize it? What is it? And if we were to explore that, we would find that each of you, it would be one thing or it would be another. It's because, well, I have bad habits. I chew my fingernails. Or I kill people. You know, whatever. A range of things. But, you know. These... whatever it is, it's something that we feel keeps us from this. It isn't just something we have done that we feel guilty about. It isn't necessarily, oh, well, I have done this act and I feel so guilty, no one could ever, ever forgive me. And meaning I can't forgive myself. That's basically nobody, most people going around not thinking whether they can forgive anybody else or not. But this is something which is much deeper than any particular. And the koan will keep arising, as Dogen says. It will manifest right before your very eyes. It'll be there all the time. It's very interesting how we cannot see our own koan. Everybody else can. And we can see everybody else's. What? You know, nothing in front of my eyes, you know, except everybody. When you have gone beyond, when you reach beyond, and it may be only for a moment, or half a moment. When you do, the eternal will manifest. The truth will manifest. And when this happens, Reverend Master has put something down on this, very important. You bless it. You bow in gratitude. And that is the most important thing to do whenever you experience the eternal, whenever you experience the truth, you realize that, so there's something that you bow in gratitude. If you do not do this, you invite going off to cash in on your experience. You'll lose something. Very important to keep that in mind. The fourth thing is the appearance or arising of the transitory. Once you have experienced this and you have blessed it, you don't stay in a kind of eternal thing. You've got to get your feet back on the ground. And that is the appearance, the arising of the transitory. You're still in the world. And you are subject to everything that that means, which means birth, aging, disease, which is disintegration, and death. Every one of us, we don't escape that experience. There's no problem with it. It's all part, everybody goes through this. It comes with being a sentient being. And it comes from being phenomenal, because all things, not only sentient beings, but all things, go through this same thing. Diamonds are not forever. One time in a million billion years from now, when the whole of the earth disintegrates by falling into the sun or whatever, they will melt. And they will no longer be diamonds. So not even diamonds are forever. The eternal and the transitory harmonize in perfect fusion is the fifth level of experience. And what that means is you remain still within this state. And it's a state in which there's the harmonization of the transitory and the eternal. You don't try in any way to make it one or the other. They go together. There's no problem. And that's a phrase I think, I'm sure, all of you have heard many times. Monks beginning something, or by saying, now, there's no problem. And they mean it. They mean that. There is no problem. Because as soon as something is said, there's a tendency for some people to go on the defensive or get ready for something, you know, praise God. But when there's no problem, it means there is no problem. And it's inviting you to sit still. Not just quiet, but still. And then whatever you do, you act from stillness. And you maintain the stillness. So you do not stay, having realized the truth, having realized the eternal, you do not stay in that state or try to hold on to that state. You let it go so that you can harmonize it. Everything that's transitory, so you don't make it into two different things. There is no difference between the transitory and the eternal. They're one. And all is different. So that's called the five. And this is what this is referring to, some of what this is referring to. The five tastes of the chi grass are the five. These are the five tastes of the chi grass. You just had a meal, by the way. That's the chi grass. And everything changes. The six sticks of Ri, this is usually not referred to gone into, but why not? You're in advanced class. I guess you can handle it. This is a reference to something that was done in Chinese culture, and so much a part of Chinese culture, that Dongshan mentions it because the Chinese would understand it. In the West, unfortunately, it is not necessarily understood. And it is the use of magical, and it is not caught up in some of the things that people do divinatory kinds of things with it. It is simply saying, all right, it is something that's come up, look at it. See what comes up. And this comes up, that comes up. It lets it, lets whatever arise, arise. And the Buddhists had a way of talking about it with people that were doing this. And you will find this in Chinese Buddhist temples. If you go up to Canada, there's a huge Buddhist temple right outside of Vancouver. And it, when you go in, it isn't in the main temple, but in the secondary temple, where they have a three-dimensional mandala, the big thing, you will see people working with these sticks. And basically what the idea is it expresses that things change, things flow. Nothing stays the same at all. It's just constantly moving, constantly moving, constantly moving. So this stick is that stick, it's some other stick that arises. So it's letting it arise, but not using it. You know, if you've got 10 things to look at, and says, okay, look at this one now. Well, you know, it's good. Okay, well, one way of doing it. Okay, I'll look at this part of it. Or it says, look at that part of you. Oh, well, then I'll look at that part of me and see what's going on. And, it, you know, it, as long as you're not caught in it, or caught up in it. However, in the West, it has been used for all kinds of mischief and with all kinds of misunderstanding and where people rule their lives by these, by the reading of the I Ching or something of this. So, for us, we just keep away from the whole thing. If the Chinese can live with it, they've been doing it for 4,000 years, fine for Chinese culture. Not necessarily fine for Western culture. Because there, the history of Western culture is, has certain forms of idiocy, which may not necessarily be carried to the degree. The Chinese have their ways of being idiots, but it's not necessarily the way we have. So therefore, we have to be careful on that. And but that's basically, it's just a matter of a reference to the changing of the flow and change of things, a constant thing, and nothing more. Do not try to make something more of it, because if you do, then you'll be making it more than Dunchan would have intended on this. When a trainee asks a question, matching answer always comes from the Zen master. When a question is asked, now this, when you have spiritual counseling and you ask a question, you will get some kind of a response. It will be a response in terms of your attitude of mind and your intention. Because the answering of a question is an intentional act. You don't inadvertently ask a question. Of the question to say, you are asking it with an intention, and the master will be responding to that. So it isn't a, if the question is an intellectual question, you might get intellectual information or not. But if you're doing San Zen, you don't ask for intellectual information as your San Zen aspect. You want to ask the question that you really is coming out of your heart, what you have sat with, that you boiled down of what you want to get at, because that is what the master will be responding to and helping you work with that, because it will be colored by your koan. It will be shaped by your koan. And he cannot do anything until you've brought up the question. Because it is a basic thing of Buddhism, as you all know, you do not, the monk doesn't go up to you and say, do you know what's the matter with you? You know what your problem is? Do you know what your koan is? No, you don't do that. You don't. You can only respond in sansan. The master can only respond when the disciple or the trainee asks the question. It has to be that way. It has to be that way. There's no forcing. There's no one trying to zap you into enlightenment. It's not the Buddha's way. You don't have to be zapped into enlightenment. You're already there. So that he may bring the trainee to the ultimate of truth, the master uses skillful means. Trainees embrace the ultimate. Masters can take the means. You already have. All he's trying to do is, Use the means to help you see that, which you already have. Correctly blended. This is good. This is what makes it work. You know, the blending of the trainee and the master, working together to help you see. Avoid one-sided clinging. This is a very important aspect in your training, because usually what happens is, the problems we have is because we are holding on to only one half of it, of what's going on. This is like victim-perpetrator karma. The person who says, why is everybody picking on me, is only looking at one side of the issue. It's not seeing how what you are doing to help foster your own victimization. And it doesn't mean that people don't get victimized. It is simply, if you've got the victim karma, of watching that, what it is, and not seeing the whole of what you're doing. And what happens with some victims, as soon as they are victimized, they respond by hitting out and doing something that keeps the karma going, keeps the wheel going, by becoming a perpetrator. And usually you'll find, whether the person is seeing himself or herself as a victim or as a perpetrator, both sides will be there. They'll be both operating very nicely together. And it's all within ourselves. And seeing that, and not thinking, I have it. It's this. This is the explanation. Now, why is everybody picking on me? Why is everybody doing this to me? Or why do I always lose my temper? I cannot seem to control my temper. Why am I always blowing up? Every time somebody says something to me, I want to go wham. It's only seeing half of it. It's only seeing one side instead of seeing the whole. This is all the natural and superior truth that doesn't attach itself to no delusion or enlightenment. Do not think you're deluded, and do not think you are enlightened. You are enlightened. Do not think you are enlightened. It calmly, clearly shows when all conditions ripen. I wonder about that. It calmly, clearly shows. Period. When minute, infinitesimally small becomes. When large, it transcends all dimension space. So don't anticipate how the eternal will manifest for you. If you think it is small, it will be even smaller. If it's large, it'll go beyond anything you think large. Because again, you're giving the eternal options. You may appear, you may do that, I may give you it in this way, or this way. You know, setting it out, planning it, planning out how the eternal will work. Even the slightest twitch will surely break the rhythm. Let it happen. Let things come by their natural course. Now we have abrupt and slow, and separated to the sects become by setting up doctrines, practices. And these become the standards that we know of all religious conduct. All right. The abrupt and the slow. This is an argument that was brought up somewhere along the line of, is enlightenment experienced gradually, or is enlightenment experienced abruptly, suddenly? How does it happen? Which, if it happens suddenly, then it can't happen gradually. If it happens gradually, then it can't happen suddenly. Has to be some kind of thing. Or is it, what is the thing? What is it this or that? All of this kind of doctrinal thing was once in Buddhism. And all it did is get the intellect going. And distinctions. And arguments. And different ways of going, different traditions of going, different schools of thought. And then these become the standards. Well, Zen is the abrupt school, and such and such is the, or Rinzai is the abrupt school, and Soto is the gradual school. No, they're not. No, they're not. You know, It comes how it comes. Even should we penetrate these doctrines, practices, and then delusive consciousness flows through the eternal truth, no progress shall we make. Even if you know what all of this stuff that the scholars in Buddhism have talked about, even if you have complete understanding of it, it isn't going to, if you are not aware of what's going on, delusive consciousness will flow through it. And you'll think, I've understood it, I've explained it, this book tells it. All of this, that's all intellect playing around with its stuff. A disciple once asked a master, obviously having been training for some time, what is meditation? And the Zen master answered, a toilet spatula. The toilet spatula was used for cleansing oneself after excreting feces. That's what meditation is. It is how we cleanse off that which the mind excretes. There's nothing dirty or filthy, but it is something to wipe away and get rid of and handle over there. And therefore, he said something which sounds crude by our standards, perhaps, but tells us something about meditation. It's how to get delusive consciousness, the delusive thinking and the thoughts that come up, and you wipe them away. And you go on about your business of living. And that is a part of your business of living. Meditation is part of your life. It's the whole part of it. If outwardly all calm we do appear, and yet within disturbed should be, we are as if a tethered horse, or as a mouse within a cage. This is the thing of watching out for getting into what I call blissing out. I am now above it all. I realize the zenith. Now all calm. And yet within the person will be disturbed because they know they haven't realized it. And they're putting it on. What Reverend Meister would call humbug. She had a very famous story about that, of a talk that was given at one of the Buddhist meetings in London, and someone got up and talked and went on about this and said, oh yes, I've gotten to a point now where I only take a little water every day and maybe a few grapes. And she looked at a friend of hers and said, humbug, humbug. And it is humbug. So, pitying this blight of people being disturbed within themselves, the former sages' teaching all dispensed. Because delusions in the trainees' minds were topsy-turvy, and they got everything backwards or upside down, this is very common, which is why they can't sort of see what's going on because they're standing on their head all the time, you know, and things look very strange from that way. All the sages too did match thereto their teachings. In other words, there is no such thing in Buddhism as the teaching, which is for every single solitary person exactly the same. This is a very important thing, because it is to the trainee's attitude of mind, to the trainee's intent, because that's what you're really feeling, that's what you're really, what's really going on in you. That is what needs responding to, not to some intellectual question. Therefore, they tried to match their teachings. Thus, they used all means, so varied, even so to say that black was white, if that would do it, to get them to see that what they're doing, they would do that. Now, we do not do the black was white, but we don't do some certain things that some masters used to do, because Westerners really don't get it. One of the things that used to be done was mirroring, which Reverend Mesh talks about in The Wild White Goose. And the idea of mirroring is if somebody's acting in a certain way, you act exactly in that way too. And then they say, oh, I'm acting that way. Oh my gosh, I'm acting. Most Westerners do not get it and think you are, they accept you for what you are and don't realize you're mirroring them. And it can really backfire. So we do not use that method here. But we do other methods on the to help, whatever it does. But it is not necessary, it is tailored to the individual. It has to be to the individual. The Buddha said, and this goes back to the Pali Canon, to those who say there is a soul or there is a self, I teach that there is no self. And to those who say there is no self, I say there is self. It is the eternal. There are two different delusions there. One is the delusion that there is a permanent absolute self, and the other denies that there is an eternal, that there is a true self. And so your answer to them, your response to them is quite different. So it isn't just the Zen masters who have been doing this. I mean, this goes all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha doing this. Delusive thought, if lost, abandoned, you can always lose it. Don't go looking to find it again. Will all satisfaction bring? If you in ancient footsteps wish to walk, observe examples old. And these are the examples that we have in the Koan stories, and the stories of the Buddha, and the scriptures, and so forth. That he could take the final step to true enlightenment. A former Buddha trained himself for 10 long kalpas, gazing at the Bodhi tree. That's how he did it. You can say, that's what you're doing. We call it a wall. That Buddha called it the Bodhi tree, the tree of enlightenment. If thus restrained, that is through the practice, freedom original is like a tiger that has tattered ears, or like a hobbled horse. All right, now what that's getting at is the former Buddha trained himself for 10 long kalpas. If he trained himself, but he was already there. But he restrained himself. So his original freedom was like a tiger that has tattered ears. Now, it's been really been fighting long. It doesn't have to fight, but it's been in the great fight. It's like a hobbled horse. Now the horse, the hobbled horse image does have certain associations, at least for me. And that is, do not wait until the donkey work is done before you do the work of the horse. Donkey work is cleaning up the karma. Don't wait until you've done all the cleaning up of the karma before you get on the horse and go forth and do good deeds. Don't say, well, I can't help anybody because I'm a mess, and until I'm completely straightened out, how could I possibly help anyone else? I can't do anything. And the thing is, you may find your own cleansing through the actual helping of others, as long as you don't force it on someone. I'm going to help you. I'm not going to go there and help you. The sage will tell a trainee who is feeling low and all inferior that on his head there gleams a jeweled diadem, and on his body rich robes hang, and at his feet there is a footrest. You now have, and I would be surprised if there wasn't one of you, at least, to whom the thought somewhere along the line when told that has not said, it doesn't apply to me. He or she couldn't be speaking to me. Not about me. They don't really know awful things I come to. Awful things. But it is so. It's not to flatter. because you do have upon your head a jeweled diadem. You have a lotus bud, and if you look in how to grow a lotus blossom, you will see through the pictures that bud appear and that bud open to full bloom. You'll see pictures of it. And in they take place. And it may not seem that it takes place in a literal level, but it takes place in a more of a literal level than might appear at first. And don't worry about it. It's just the blossoming. And there is a blossoming for it. If the trainee hears this teaching with surprise and doubt, the sage assures him that of cats there are some kinds, and also some white cows that perfect are just as they are. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. People perfect, yeah. Oh, yes, yeah, yeah. People are. Not me, yeah. The goal is not to be perfect. Practice makes perfect. Fui does not. What happens is, when you practice, when you do your training, you realize an excellence through repetition. It is what's called fully perfecting enlightenment. Not attaining being perfect, never making a mistake, never doing anything wrong, ever again. Perfect. Everything I touch is perfect. Everything I do is perfect. Everything I say is perfect. Many, many Zen masters of great spiritual realization have fallen flat on their faces. And then they have to get up, push themselves up, and go on. And there are stories, the koan stories of masters who have blown it. But they didn't blow it for all eternity. They are not for condemning themselves. Sometimes you do the two arrows meet in midair, and sometimes they don't even come close to each other. A master archer hits a target at 100 yards because he still possesses. But to make two arrows meet in midair, head on, goes far beyond the skill of ordinary men. You can ask a question of a Zen master, a spiritual question, and if things work, two arrows may meet. But you can ask that same question of any person who has not had training, has not had a realization, and there can be no meeting. Do not look out there for that kind of meeting, because they do not know how or what it is. If they did, they would not be doing what they're doing. They would not be ordinary men. In this superior activity of no mind, see, the wooden figure sings and the stone maiden dances. Who's the wooden figure? Who's the stone maiden?
The trainee.
Hmm?
The trainee.
Yeah, that's one easy way.
Rocks, stones, fence posts.
Rocks, stones, and fence posts. Yeah. Have you ever seen rocks, stones, and fence posts that dance? Have you ever heard them sing? not last Thursday.
I'd rather not answer that.
I didn't expect you to. No, it's a question there of it's yes, it is that, and what else? What else is it? What else goes on? Yeah.
Doesn't it mean all things have the Buddha nature?
Well, all things do have the Buddha nature. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, including...
But do stone maidens have to dance in order to prove that all things are the Buddha nature?
It seems possible.
Okay.
Well, the image for me is just, I mean, it is that in a certain place of whatever, inner awareness, all things come to life, and that it doesn't, that beyond the solidity or the seeming solidities, there's the song of the eternal, there's a movement, there's an aliveness that's beyond life.
Right. In this superior activity of no mind, what are you doing there? You're looking into the mirror, and you're doing what you said. You see, things that are solid are alive. They move, they flow, they dance, they sing. And you let them arise, and you let them go. This is the most excellent mirror in samadhi. Yes.
What that brings up for me is the when it says in the scripture, great wisdom, when one with wisdom great, all obstacles dissolve. That's what it sort of
says. It's the letting go.
Because it's referring to the previous lines about the 2 hours moving in the air. And mm-hmm. in talking with the master and having the koan made clear and having it dissolve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what happens? The stone maiden sings and then it wouldn't...
All things are possible.
All things are possible.
Even the most terrible solidified karma can dissolve.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This is far beyond all common consciousness, beyond all thinking. The retainer serves his lord, the emperor. His father does the child obey. Without obedience, there is no filial piety, and if there is no service, no advice. This had very special meaning, historically. In China, Buddhism was looked down upon by the Confucianists, partly because they did not, their scriptures that were written in Chinese, or the writing, the translation of them, was not put in the form that was used for 1500 years. Which was based on the writings of a disciple of Confucius called Mencius. Because they did not write like that, and that was the way that all the Chinese mandarins learned to write, in the style of Mencius, they looked down upon Buddhism. They were also afraid of Buddhism because it seemed not to support the views of Chinese culture. So there's something is said here in code. It says, the retainer serves his lord, the emperor. His father does the child obey. The child obeys his father. And there is a saying in Mencius that says, when a father is a father, and a son is a son, when a brother, an older brother is an older brother, and a younger brother is a younger brother, all is right in heaven. And when all is right in heaven, all is right in earth. Everyone lays out his dutiful role. The retainer serves his lord, the emperor, has a meaning in Buddhism that is slightly different from that. That's the lord of the house. That is his emperor. We are not the rulers. The eternal is the ruler. The lord of the house is the ruler. And we serve them. His father does the child obey. The child obeys that eternal. And it is this sense of doing that that moves it out of the social realm of obedience. And these are also the models for the relationship between the disciple, the trainee, and the master. You serve your master. The disciple serves the master. Because if you do not, are not willing to do that, then what advice can be given to you? You're not seeing that you have a relationship. And what goes on, such action and most unpretentious work all foolish seems and dull. This is not, this is something that you find that when you're working, you're training, and you're training under a master, you can find this over and over again, that it's small things that will be pointed out. It isn't just the great cosmic thing to talk about things. It's in your everyday working, your everyday habits, your everyday thoughts, your everyday feelings, the everydayness of it. And those are the things that you look at. Those are the things you work with. And it may seem all foolish and dull. But those who practice thus this law continually shall in all worlds be called Lord of Lords unto eternity. Willingness to train. Not on just this or that, but in every way, in every day. When you do that, then things open up. This is not what this text means, what I have talked about. Do not think that it is. As you train, and as you read this, and as you memorize it, and as it becomes part of your blood and bones, there are meanings in here, there are things, and by that I mean there are things that this has to say to you in your training, that it will have to say to you if you just let it. Let it happen. Let it arise. Don't try to force it. And you will find that whatever I have said here does not even begin to resemble what is, or even come close to it. It's just fancy words. Homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.